This is part six in our study of humility and prophecy. Paul was very clear in 1 Corinthians 13 that the primary gift of the Holy Spirit is love. And in trying to put the other gifts in perspective, he said regarding the gift of prophecy, our prophecy is always incomplete. That's verse 9, Phillips. Because of that, we are suggesting any discussion of prophecy be tempered with love and humility, with a recognition none of us has a complete and perfect view of prophetic matters. Now, I'm not sure that's been the view of many in our circles. Were that the view, we would experience no divisions over prophecy, when in fact, our divisions have largely been over prophetic views. They've been over the acceptance or not of certain time prophecies, in particular, the 6,000 years leading to the beginning of the millennium in 1874, and the Jubilee calculation leading to the beginning of the times of restitution in 1874. Now, this series of studies has been for one purpose, to examine our time prophecies critically and suggest there is sufficient reason to question their validity. And through doing that, encourage a respectful humility as regards whatever views we may hold on these issues. You know, it's always interested me, if you look at the chart at the back of the first volume, with all those overlapping lines, oh my goodness, it's almost as if Brother Russell was sending a signal of, I'm not so sure about something here. It could start here, it could start here, maybe there. In our last lesson, we examined the 1260 days, which are first mentioned in Daniel, followed up on in Revelation. That period is the most mentioned time prophecy in the Bible. That fact alone suggests it's more significant than a period of 1,260 years that ended four centuries ago in 1799. We saw the greatest problem with those making those days into years was that they are the days of the second half of Daniel's 70th week. Those weeks had already and properly been changed into weeks of years, so that each of the 70 weeks represented not 7 days, but 7 years. Hence, after 69 of those weeks were fulfilled, that would take us 483 years from what the angel said was the starting point. And that works out well, as it does take us to the time of Jesus' baptism, which is what the angel said it would, and Brother Jim presented that, I thought, perfectly last week. Daniel 9:25, unto Messiah the Prince. So logically, if each of the 70 weeks represents 7 years, then the 70th week represents 7 years. And the angel says that week is divided in half, leaving 3.5 years, 1,260 days, or 42 months in the last half. Now, you can't take those last 1,260 days and then make them over again into years. Doesn't seem fair. We saw in Daniel, this is crucial, the event that marks the beginning of that last 1,260 days is a taking of Jerusalem, the end of daily sacrifice, and in its place the setting up of the abomination. Daniel 9:27 NIV. In the middle of the seven, that's the last seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering, and on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation. Now, you can read any translation or manuscript, as far as I know, and you will find the abomination of desolation mentioned in connection with the middle of the last week of Daniel's 70th week in verse 27. The 70th week, therefore, cannot have run consecutively with the other 69. The abomination was not set up when Jesus was crucified, which is what the 69 took us to. It has to be separated to the end of the age because that is where Jesus places the abomination. And even says in that connection, you can read about it in Daniel. Now, in his discussion of Daniel in volume 3, Brother Russell makes a profound statement regarding understanding prophecy. This is on page 25. Quote, its testimony is still sealed to very many prophetic students because the central item of the prophecy upon which much depends has already had a seeming fulfillment. This manner of covering or hiding a prophecy until its due time to be revealed is by no means uncommon. Now, following up on that thought, he says later, same page, quote, this seeming fulfillment of the prophecy is sufficient to satisfy the general student, content to believe what he's told. And it causes him to lose interest in the prophecy as one fulfilled in the past and of no special interest to him. Brilliant points. If we have been convinced so much prophecy is really in the past, we will lose interest in it and not examine it critically. Now, in fact, we must keep this in mind continually. Our prophetic views are primarily shaped by what we've studied for the past 100 years. The time prophecies and the conclusions based on them. When Brother Russell was writing about prophecy, he wrote from what we have to admit is a flawed premise. Now, this was a premise he inherited from the Second Adventist. He didn't make it up. And that premise was everything ends in 1914, the church complete, kingdom established. Now, the big problem that created was it necessitated looking at all prophecy as essentially fulfilled. You couldn't put it that much in the future because everything had to be over in 1914. Now, he was so convinced of this premise that even after 1914 had come and gone, he still wrote in the foreword to Volume 3, page 2, quote, evidently the door is not yet shut. Although we anticipate that before a very long time, perhaps a year or two or three, the full number of the elect will be completed and will have gone beyond the veil and the door will be shut. End of quote. Now, don't misunderstand. I'm not bringing this up to be critical of Brother Russell. I'm bringing this up to demonstrate how that belief in 1914 colored his prophetic writings and views. And in our loyalty to him, we have accepted those views. And by doing so, we have fallen prey to his observation in volume 3 that one can be blinded to the meaning of prophecy by believing its events are all in the past. And that is, by and large, our accepted view of much prophecy. Our accepted view of Daniel is it is almost 100% fulfilled. Nothing in Daniel will speak of in the future. Our accepted view of Revelation, even though its very title is that it is about the revelation of Jesus Christ, which is to say his return, it's presented as if it's a history book. To this day, almost all of Revelation is viewed as if fulfilled in the past. One of our magazines that most of us read recently devoted a whole issue to Revelation, basically placing most of it in the past as if it's a history of the gospel age. Even Matthew 24 is viewed as if it too is at least partly a history of the gospel age. The result of this can be harmful to the faith of some, as we just read in the foreword to Volume 3. We have, as a movement, been conditioned to expect things to happen soon. Brother Russell expected church complete 2 or 3 years. Now, shortly after Brother Russell's death, his organization and its adherents, including Russell Pollock from this class, were preaching millions now living will never die and guaranteeing the kingdom in 1925. It made for a lot of excitement and then a lot of disappointment. Dates for the kingdom always do that. Excitement followed by disappointment. Then a new date, and the cycle starts all over again. To this day, every time something happens in Israel, we get excited, thinking, well, now, time has come. This is not necessarily healthy. I'm concerned for the young people, college educated about history. I'm concerned they may look at these things and wonder about the legitimacy of all our views. I'm concerned with their advanced education. They may see through many of the things we still hold dear, like these time prophecies. And then allow that to cast doubt on our essential views listed in to us the scriptures clearly teach. This misunderstanding of time as regards the plan of God may have been predicted. In Hebrews 10, 36 and 37, there may be a suggestion that the Lord's people are going to miscalculate regarding the timing of things. There Paul quotes Habakkuk 2:3. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. One of the most important things to notice here is that phrase, the vision is yet for an appointed time. God appoints the times and seasons. He knows all of them in advance. Nothing ever goes wrong as regards his appointed times. We make a mockery of God's omnipotence when we say, he planned for things to end some time ago. It's just that the church members didn't get themselves ready on time. Or when we say, We can hasten the kingdom by working harder on ourselves. Brethren, we have and will even make God wrong, so we don't have to admit we're wrong in our calculations. Now let's go deeper into that verse. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Now, did you notice an apparent contradiction there? How can a thing tarry on the one hand and not tarry on the other hand? How's that? Though it tarry, wait for it, it will not tarry. It's a contradiction. There's only one explanation I can think of that comes to mind. From the human point of view, it tarries. From the divine point of view, it does not. It will come at the appointed time. But humans made up the appointed time for themselves. They were wrong. But failing to admit that, they live with a sense of, and we've all heard it, a sense of, why are things taking so long? Things are taking so long because we appointed the times and seasons through our calculations, and they were wrong. It's right there in Acts 1, 6 and 7. It's been there all along. They asked Jesus, "Wilt thou at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" They wanted a date for the kingdom. Jesus' answer was so clear. It is not for you to know. I mean, much is given to the church to know. And Paul said that we can know something about prophecy, but not all things about prophecy. Jesus said, it is not for you to know the times or seasons which the Father hath put in his own power. Brethren, imagine for a moment what history would be like if all of Jesus' followers had accepted this simple statement. If in all humility they lived with the fact, this is something not for us to know. But humans have trouble with that. There's that expression, know-it-alls. There's something in fallen human nature that demands to know the unknowable and pretend it's known. And it's not as if Jesus hadn't stressed this before. Matthew 24:16. But of that day and hour knoweth no man. Matthew 24:15. Watch therefore, for ye know not, neither the day nor the hour. Brethren, we're suggesting that these prophecies in Daniel, almost all of them, look sequential, but they are not. This is true to the entire Old Testament presentation of the coming of the Messiah. Things were bunched together prophetically so that it looked like the coming of the Messiah would mean a kingdom established on earth with peace and tranquility, reigning, and Israel restored. That's what it read like. And that's one of the reasons those disciples said to Jesus, well, are you now going to set up the kingdom? It was hard to recognize without the Holy Spirit that there are two phases to the coming of the Messiah. He comes to suffer later in glory. A very sincere and deep Jewish thinker, Dennis Prager, who has written a great commentary on Exodus and now one on Genesis, the Rational Bible, was asked by a Christian what kept him from accepting Christ as the Messiah? And his answer was, and he's a serious student of the Old Testament and practitioner, his answer was, I don't see peace brought on the earth. You see, it's hard to see in the Old Testament that break in time between the first and second comings of the Messiah. There is, I'm inclined to believe, a likewise break in time in these prophecies in Daniel. For instance, the feet of the image. We've looked at this. With its 10 toes representing 10 kings, take us up to the time, Daniel says it, the saints possess the kingdom. Because the angel interprets the stone that smites the image on its feet as the kingdom, which is set up, quote, in the days of these kings. That's the 10 kings of the toes. So the last kings of that image take us up to the setting up of the kingdom, which is, we saw this in other parts of Daniel, the saints in glory with Jesus. So the image isn't a sequential picture. There's a gap between the legs of iron and the feet, part of iron, part of clay. Likewise, the 70 weeks. They look sequential, but we've seen very good reason to believe that last week is cut off from the rest and doesn't transpire till the end of the age. Likewise, in Daniel 7 and Daniel 8, you've got these animals representing kingdoms, but they aren't sequential. Why? Because the last of those animals presents us with that little horn, and we saw many examples of its actions as destroying the church until the church possessed the kingdom. Daniel 7, 21, 22. I beheld, and the same horn made war with these saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. That couldn't be clearer. Now there's a real sequence. The saints persecuted by this ruler right up to the time they possessed the kingdom. That means the last days of the saints on this earth are going to be tumultuous, characterized by persecution and suffering. They're going to go out with a bang, not a whimper. And how long is this horn given to carry out this destruction on the church? Daniel 7, 25. They shall be given unto his hand until a time and times and dividing of time. There's our last 1260 days, the last half of Daniel's 70th week. Another proof that week is separated from the rest and doesn't take place till the end of the age. It follows the pattern of the entire Old Testament, leaving readers with the impression everything happens at once, and hides the gospel age development of the church. Here's how these 70 weeks are described by the angel. This is Daniel 9:24. Now, look at all that is said to transpire within these 70 weeks. Notice how the reader gets the impression it all happens at once. 70 weeks are determined. Now, let's stop there for a moment. That word determined is 2852 and means to cut off. And it's interesting to note that in the description of these 70 weeks, parts of them are cut off from the rest. 7 weeks, then 62 weeks, and then 1 week. Anyway, continuing. Are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. See, Jerusalem's involved here. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. You get the picture. There is a sense here of so much happening at once, when in reality, this is spread out over time, as are the 70 weeks. Now, back to that horn, showing it is a power at the very end of the age. Daniel 8:9. And out of one of them came forth a little horn. Daniel 8:11. By him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. That is what the other prince, not Jesus the prince, but the other prince in the prophecy of the 70 weeks is said to do in the middle of the week. Daniel 9:27. In the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. So, there seems to be ample reason to view all these prophecies in Daniel as not necessarily sequential, but at a certain point jumping to the end of the age, thus tending to hide their true meaning, as they can look as if they belong in the past. And as Brother Russell said, once you believe a prophecy is fulfilled in the past, you no longer look at it or care to understand its true fulfillment. Now, we're going to jump into Revelation 13, if you want to go there in your Bibles. And we're going to see how a false understanding of the 1260 days as being years leads to a false conclusion regarding some of the symbols of Revelation. In the traditional understanding, our Bible student understanding, the beast of Revelation 13 is the papacy. The dragon is pagan Rome. The image of the beast is the Church of Great Britain and Ireland. We're really tough on other churches, aren't we? Or to put it simply, it's all in the past. Now here is what it says about the beast. This is Revelation 13:5. There was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Now verse 7. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Now let's go back to Daniel and see who does these things. Verse 7 in Revelation 13 is a quote from Daniel 7:21. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. Now look at verse 22. In Daniel 7. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. The beast of Revelation 13, therefore, holds sway until the church is complete and possesses the kingdom. If you tie the quote from Revelation 13 back to Daniel where it came from originally. Therefore, that 42 months mentioned in Revelation 13:5 is not a period ending in 1799, but is actual days ending at the point the church possessed the kingdom. Further proof later in chapter 7 of Daniel, verse 24 speaks of a king that shall arise. He does exactly what the beast of Revelation 13 does. Verse 25, he shall speak great words against the Most High, shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and they shall be given unto his hand until a time and time, dividing of times. Same amount of time, the beast of Revelation 13 is given to destroy the saints. And what happens after that 3.5 years? Daniel 7:27. The kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Again, we see this power operating and reigning until the church is complete. The 1260 days end the persecution of the church forever. As from that point on, Daniel says over and over again, they possess the kingdom. Now, I don't get the accepted interpretation that says the dragon of Revelation 13:4 is pagan Rome. Quote, and they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. We've been told that dragon is pagan Rome, and the giving of power to the beast was Rome's support of papacy as a governmental partnership of sorts. Now, I don't understand it, because Revelation clearly says who the dragon is. Doesn't leave it up to us to come up with our interpretation. This is Revelation 12:9. And the great dragon was cast out. Now watch as this dragon is defined, not once, but 3 different times. Quote, that old serpent, called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world, he was cast out under the earth, and the angels cast out, and his angels were cast out with him. Now, brethren, was pagan Rome that old serpent? Old because that serpent goes back to the Garden of Eden. Did pagan Rome deceive the whole world? Did pagan Rome have angels that followed it? Go to verse 10. And yet another description of the dragon. The accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. Did pagan Rome have access to God in the spirit realm to be able to accuse our brethren? Verse 12 shows this is not something that has to do with ancient history. Verse 12 shows this is very close to the time Satan is bound. Quote, woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil's come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. And in Revelation 20, verse 2, we read this about the dragon. And laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil, and bound him 1,000 years. This specifically says the dragon is bound. Do we believe pagan Rome is what is going to be bound for 1,000 years? Finally, and this is a huge blow to the interpretation that the beast of Revelation 13 is the papacy. Now, by and large, the brethren believe Babylon represents the Catholic system. Okay. Now, if we go into Revelation 17:12, this is what we find. The 10 horns on the beast are said to be kings. And in verse 13, quote, they give their power and strength unto the beast. Now in verse 1, Babylon is described, defined as the great whore. Try to follow this. It is these 10 kings doing the will of the beast who do the following. Quote, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and give their kingdom unto the beast. Revelation 17, 16, 17. So you see, in that scripture, the beast is clearly one thing, and the whore, Babylon, is another altogether, with the beast acting against the whore. So, the beast can't be papacy or the Catholic Church, as it is the beast with the support of 10 kings who destroy Babylon. It's right there in Revelation. Clear. Okay, we're at the end of this. Hopefully, we have presented enough evidence to at least suggest putting the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation into the far distant past is not supported in the scriptures. May this encourage our humility as regards our prophetic views. They best be a little more elastic in our minds than ironclad. And certainly we want to cut all our brethren plenty of slack regarding prophetic issues. They're complex. None of us can have a complete and perfect view of prophecy on this side of the veil. So let's live and let live. Every time someone disagrees with you on prophecy, just say, well, there it is. Apostle Paul predicted that. We don't all have a perfect view. And of course, you'll think you have the one, you're the one with the perfect view. They're not. But it could very well be the other way around. Or you know what? Could be both of you are dead wrong. And it's best to let these evil forces that are mentioned in Daniel and Revelation make war with the saints instead of us making war with the saints, because they lack allegiance to our prophetic interpretations. Lord willing, in our next study, we may attempt to see who the scriptures suggest this horned beast is that persecutes the church at the very end of the age. And I want to conclude with a paraphrase of something Brother Tim Thomason said many, many years ago. I'm paraphrasing, but the gist of what he said was, when the day comes that we stand before the judgment seat of Christ, what's not going to be asked of us is whether or not we have accepted perfectly all the doctrines the Bible students say we have to have accepted. We're not going to be asked either, what have we done? The concern will be with our transformation. What have you become? May the Lord add his blessings to this consideration, of course, with the acknowledgement. Could be dead wrong. We're just doing the best we can right now.